Welcome to Pete's Pub. I'm your host, Pete Kemmerer. This is Episode 7, release date Sunday, August 3rd, 2025. Today we have a ginormous episode, a recent interview with three of the four members of a very interesting and talented original music band, Bellwether Ritual. We'll talk about their origin and how the band has changed, their songwriting process, gear, working on their first full-length LP, and more. So, without further ado, let's get into it. And welcome to Three Quarters of Bellwether Ritual. How you doing, guys?
Doing well, Pete. Thanks for having us.
Oh, great. I want to, before we even start, I just want to thank all three of you for coming, taking the time to do this. I used to hate doing this in a band, but I'm really stoked about you guys. And I was telling Mike before we got started a little bit about that, so I'll share that with you guys too, because I really like you guys. And I have specific reasons for liking you guys, and I'm going to tell you about those. And I hope other people listen and then say, you know, that Pete, he's pretty straightforward. He's got his head on pretty straight. Maybe I should go hear Bellwether Ritual live.
Damn right.
You clearly have good taste.
I have excellent taste, and I'm very picky, and I like you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Before we get started, we got a little issue.
Yeah.
We lost the great Ozzy Osbourne today.
Yeah, that was I think, Hillary, you were the first one who kind of sent it around through the thread. And I don't know, I just read it and was like, no way.
I mean, I'm sure we'll talk shop about this pretty. I heard you guys were talking shop about this, and I'm pretty pissed that I missed it already. But yeah, I think we're all pretty destroyed by it. So,
yeah. Is he one of your influences, Hillary?
Black Sabbath is one of my all-time favorite bands. Black Sabbath and Geezer. And I mean, it goes without saying, we'll talk bassists in a minute, but yeah. I mean, Geezer's clearly one of my top influences, as I'm sure we'll discuss. But yeah, I mean, it goes without saying. I was trying everything in my power to get to that Back to the Beginning concert. I was up at midnight in line, and like, so needless to say, I think we're all pretty heavily impacted by it.
Did you stream it?
I did, yeah. And I mean, I'll probably watch it over and over again. So there's definitely a lot of emotional moments in there. Yeah. I would have thought that it would have led to this, but
I know they're going to make it into a movie, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. And I'll definitely catch that. How about you, Steve? How do you feel about Ozzy and Black Sabbath? And
well, I'll tell you, one of the first pieces of music I had was the We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll kind of compilation cassette tape. And I wore that thing out, man. It had front to back. It was amazing. And I remember when I first started getting into music, I hunted through my father's record collection, specifically looking for the first Black Sabbath album. And wouldn't you know it, it was in the very last box of records I looked through. And I legitimately remember tearing up when I found it. And I still have it. And it's my favorite album of all time. And anytime I listen to it, there's so many moments when I'm just like, oh, that's where I got that lick from.
Yeah.
It's just in my DNA, man. So I'm, as well as you guys, very bummed.
How about you, Mike? What are your thoughts on Ozzy's passing? And
yeah, I mean, obviously it's a rough one. You know, he was talking about dying on stage. Actually, that's one of the things he was saying. That would have been a great way to go out. And I think there are people, you know, in life, a lot of times people hold on for a specific amount of time or for a specific date or day or something that really resonates with them. And then once they hit that, they kind of, you know, I don't want to say they go downhill quickly after that. So that might be the case here where he was just holding on. For that particular show. So I came in, I was a grunge kid growing up, and that's what I first got into. And he was in his No More Tears album cycle for that. So that's when I first kind of got into that. And then I kind of worked backwards into Sabbath. But Sabbath was definitely one of the bands that we would post as like, that's one of our pillar bands that everyone kind of agrees on, you know, which, you know, can be tough when you have a group of musicians. You're always trying to find that common ground, and that was, it still is one of the, I would say probably the biggest one. I mean, there's a couple other bands too, but that one, we always keep coming back to that one.
Yeah.
So, what's interesting about it too is that there's so many different, as you go through their entire album history, I feel like there's kind of, there's details from each album that are very characteristic of each of us. And then, you know, intertwined, I think that's like, you know, it really demonstrates a lot of our individual influences. And so merged together.
Yeah.
I think that's where we find common ground, but there's certainly like little details across the board that you could pick out across, you know, from each of us individually.
Well, I can definitely hear the influence when you listen to Bellwether Ritual music. I can definitely hear the influences of all of them, including Brenton's drumming. I mean, I always thought Bill Ward was amazing. And Geezer was one of my first three bassists that really got me thinking I want to be a bass player. Geezer Butler, Mel Shocker, and Gary Thane from Uriah Heep. When I heard those three guys play, I just knew I needed to be a bass player. That's it. I've always been a bass player. I dabbled with guitar, but it's like, no, I'm not, you know, I was always a bassist, and I tried guitar for a little bit, but I was never fast enough or shifty enough like you guitarists.
So. We don't have to be flashy like these assholes.
I know. These assholes. And you know what they do, too? They turn down our amps and theirs up.
Oh, you don't even have to tell me.
I'm telling you. It's true. And they're like gnomes. You don't even know they're doing it. Like, you're doing something and you're playing and all of a sudden you can't hear yourself.
The two of them, thick as thieves.
Yeah. And you turn around and they're just standing where they were before. They're like super fast or something.
One of us distracts her and then the other one goes and turns it down. That's why there's two guitar players in this band.
Gotta watch guitarists. Don't get me started about drummers. He's not here to defend himself, so we won't talk about drummers.
Yeah.
those three got me thinking about bass. And then of course, you know Hillary knows, you just get into bass and it's like, well, that's my groove, that's my thing.
I actually started on bass. That was my first instrument.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mistakenly heard the beginning of Metallica's Wherever I Am at Rome and thought it was bass. And I was like, holy cow, I want to do that.
And
then, picked up the bass, and that was around the Nirvana time too. So I learned a bunch of those old school songs. And then switched over once I got sick and tired of waiting for guitar players to show up and vocalists to show up, and just basically like, all right, well, I'm gonna do it if no one else is gonna be reliable enough to do it. So.
Yeah, you do a great job, and when people see you live, like, just hear one song, just one song, pick a song, you know, Lock and Key. I mean, but listen to any of your songs that you do. You've got that down. Your presence is good. Your vocals are great. Your harmonizing with Hillary is great. I was telling you before the podcast that I tune out to the stuff because I just can't take it. But with you guys, I don't. And I was trying to figure out why. And I think it's just this dark energy. And then Hillary comes in and harmonizes with you and brings just a little bit of brightness to it that it needs. And then it just works. You know, and I think it's a really good idea that she's singing with you. So
it's
that's
funny that you mentioned that, because at first I was really self-conscious about it. Like, does it take some of the, like, does it brighten it too much, you know? And so we kind of dabble with a couple, you know, when it comes to my influences, it's interesting because I share a lot of the same bass influences as you, but vocally, you know, I'm really into Pet Sounds and like the Wall of Sound and things like that. And a lot of that shows up in a lot of the vocal arrangements we do. So it's a really cool counterpoint. And like, you know, at first I was a little hesitant, but the team, I was going to say, the guys are really supportive.
It's good,
you know, in terms of getting creative in that regard. So it's really coming together.
I could even see a little bit of that in your film that you guys did outside of the donut shop. There was a little bit of timidity there at a couple of spots in one of the songs, and then I don't even know if a lot of people caught that. But I'm watching. It's like, yeah, she's like, you know, but it came off really nice. So it sounded great, and people got to hear you go. Hear you guys live. It's just insane.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to jump in real quick too. When Hillary came on board, that to me was like a big turning point in the band as well. She brought a lot of like those doomier influences. So we were definitely a different band, and Steve as well. I mean, as each person comes in, they change, and you have to kind of learn to embrace that, and just wherever it goes, it goes. You can't try, at least I can't try to direct it too much. I don't know, they might tell you something different, but as new people come in, you want to give them their chance to shine and all that. So, and good to go back to Sabbath, they were always like, you can't be dark all the time, you have to have a little bit of light, and then it makes it the darker stuff and the heavier and the heavier stuff even heavier once that hits. So that's something we do try to keep in mind too.
And I should also say also that Steve's soloing style lends to that as well. Steve rides above the doomy parts of it when he hits his solos. It really, again, it brightens it up, it lifts it up for a second. And a lot of bands that play the type, I hate to classify it as type of music, because you guys don't even have a real type. You're a whole different animal. But the type of music that you play, just let me say it, and then a lot of them don't go for the guitar solo with a little bit of high-end shred. And Steve does. And that helps the band, in my opinion. And like, so with her harmonizing with you, and then Steve's bringing it up over the top with a solo, even if it's a little tasty solo. The outro of I can't remember the name of the song now, I'm sorry, but there's an outro of a song. It's Lock and Key. The outro of Lock and Key, you have a little outro solo there, right? And it lifts the whole thing, right? You know, because that's a pretty heavy duty song, and then all of a sudden you got that little bit, and it's just enough, you know. So anyway, my opinion, I'm talking too much.
Yeah, that's a tasty morsel. Like, you can't, like, you kind of have to go under the hood for it too, you know, because there's such a cacophony of stuff going on at the end, but it dials it in just perfectly. It's like a nice little Easter egg, you know?
Yeah.
So
works for me, I'll tell you. I already said this to Mike before the recording, but just for the record, I appreciate Mike's a good guy. You guys know that, right?
We're lying.
Sometimes, okay.
Well, no, all joking aside, yes.
I played for a local band for a couple of years up there in the Lehigh Valley area, and I just left them in April, and Mike was kind enough to come out to Grumpy's Barbecue during one of my very early performances, where I played in front of a fireplace, and he was there to cheer me on, and that made me feel very good. So I appreciated that very much. So thank you, Mike.
Oh, of course, man.
I hope you had good. I hope you had some.
Like, yeah, you sounded great.
Oh, thanks, man. I hope you enjoyed the barbecue there.
We should though.
There you go.
Barbecue and Tullamore Dew.
Yeah.
There you go. So where are you guys from? Where are you from, Hillary?
That's a loaded question, because I'm a nomad, I would say, by trade. I have lived in a lot of different places, but the short answer is I was born in South Florida, so I have a lot of musical influences from my upbringing down there, certainly. But I spent most of my adult life in Chicago. That's really, I got ingratiated into the punk and metal scenes there. And certainly, you know, there's a vast history of all different types of music that Chicago is the intersection of. So,
You
know, I was lucky enough to kind of be ingratiated into both communities, and moved here recently. Looking for the same kind of community. I was lucky to find it the old fashioned way on Craigslist.
God bless Craigslist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And where all good bands start.
You know, all the social media, all the unique ways you can connect with bands. And like, at the end of the day, sometimes you just got to do it organically. So that's the closest to it these days, if you're not meeting people out on the scene.
Well, that's how I got hooked up with my last band, and hopefully my next one as well. Something happened today that I can't talk about. But hopefully a positive thing will come from that.
Yeah, break a leg.
Mike can tell you off the air.
Are you joining Bellwether Ritual? Because I'm very pissed if you are.
I wouldn't dare. So, Steve, where are you from, man?
Yeah, I'm from the Philadelphia area. The suburbs, kind of near the airport. I lived there until I was basically right out of high school, and then I lived in Jersey for a little bit, and then moved up to the Lehigh Valley. yeah, I grew up down there playing in punk bands and metal bands, and all I knew was my little tiny community. I didn't know there was a world out there. And I moved up when I moved to the Valley, and it was just, I mean, scenery is infinitely better than the Philadelphia suburbs for one. But I've over the years met so many great musicians. I've played jazz and blues and all sorts of different kind of music. And past couple of years, finally made it full circle back to really wanting to play heavy metal and that kind of stuff. And to get back to Mike being a wonderful person, I found this band on Craigslist also, and you know, one of the things that really drew me to it was the amount of community building that this band seems to encourage. If anyone listening isn't familiar, Mike did a podcast for, I don't know, 4 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Where, like, every week he'd interview different people from the Valley and beyond about their creative endeavors and everything. And I just thought it was swell.
Yeah.
And the bummer
I was on one of those.
Yeah, you were, but yeah, Steve never was. That was kind of a bummer.
Well, we tried, remember?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. And then had
technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's one of those things I hated to do, but it ended up being really nice because Mike was a really good host.
Thanks, man.
Well, it's true. And so, Mike, you're from the, where are you from?
I am born and raised in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And then shortly after college, moved down to Philadelphia for 7 or so years and played in a bunch of bands down there. Similar to Steve, everything from like, I don't know, I'd say maybe like early 2000s post-rock-ish stuff to a country band, playing bass mostly. And then while I was down there is when I started making the switch to more guitar, like writing more songs. And that's really when I decided to switch over. I've always played guitar and bass, but decided to switch over to guitar and vocals and really try to actually write stuff. And then instead of trying to find a band to join, start a band to build from, because that hopefully would last a little bit longer. And so far, so good. And then came back for family reasons, and then actually quit music for a while, maybe 4 or 5 years, just didn't play guitar, didn't do anything. And then COVID hit, and I had found myself with a lot of time on my hands. And decided to get back into it. And then at some point, it was like, well, let's see if we can make a band out of this and a go. So posted on Craigslist, and had the first iteration of Bellwether in 2021, and then to your point earlier, I do feel like the most challenging part of all of this is finding the right people to play with.
Yeah.
And not just in a musical sense. I mean, you have to be able to communicate and get along, as these two can definitely tell you. We've been doing a lot of that recently. You know, we have a lot kind of packed in the pipeline that we're trying to get through. And that's a really important part of it. So we take the time when necessary.
You're in the middle of putting together your first full-length LP.
Yes.
Talk about pressure and stress and, oh my God.
All the things, yeah.
All the things.
While trying to play a couple shows too. So, yeah. I don't know, Hillary, you want to talk about that? We kind of hit her on a similar kind of idea when we were tossing demos around. And, well, yeah, why don't you go ahead and get into that a little bit?
I think there were a couple of songs that... I don't know. I think I was motivated a lot. I don't know. I guess I was inspired a lot or reading a lot about the Salem witch trials and like just that general era of mysticism and things like that. And I was wordsmithing a couple of things. So the album, as you'll find, is very much rooted in kind of that whole concept. And we'll dig into it in a little bit. Yeah, I think that's really where it came from. Just this, and what it really turned into was, you know, what was originally kind of an exploratory thing where I was just digging really far into history became this social commentary about, you know, the state of things right now and just how self-indulgent people are in general. And so you'll see these kind of social cues throughout the album, but essentially all instigated by what was this kind of just weird detour into that era of history. And it's now turned into this super rad concept album. So with everybody's unique influences, you know, as you get through the album, there's a lot of different themes and motifs, and you know, from start to finish, there's a story to be told. But you know, throughout it, you can kind of see where everybody played a more obvious leadership role, I would say, based on the influences. So yeah, and we're super excited about it.
Yeah, it's one of the most difficult things I've found, maybe you guys found too, is that you need to be able to be vulnerable and to give and accept criticism without taking it personally and without being defensive. That's difficult in a band because you're more than just bandmates, no matter how you look at it. You're friends, but it's also something even deeper than in some ways, because you're actually playing off each other. I mean, and you're improving the music by having these interactions, and that's where it can be really fragile if you're not careful and if you don't have the right people. And if you do have the right people, which I hope you guys do now, and it sure looks like you've got a handle on it. I hope so. Knock wood.
What's interesting too is, that's definitely something that we're experiencing that and kind of learning how to give and take criticism.
Yeah.
I'll call it constructive feedback. Yeah. But at the end of the day, everybody offers and accepts criticism in a different way.
Yes.
And everybody writes music very differently in this band. Yeah. We all write very distinctively, and
right,
so,
and of course everything you write is important to you, but it's important to be able to listen to somebody else's take on it, and maybe they have a different idea that works better to serve the song, and that's hard to do. And it can be even simple things, you know. A quick story I'll share is my guitarist had said to me after 2 years of practicing in the same tiny little basement that we practiced in, it's like, "You're too loud." And I said, "What do you mean I'm too loud? I'm the same as I've always been." He said, "You've always been too loud." And so, you know what I did? I took my amp, which is a little Fender 100 water, right? Rumble. And I turned it 90 degrees so it faced the drummer. And I played. I said, "How's that?" He says, "Oh, that's great." I said, "So why didn't you tell me before instead of being so angry all the time?"
For 2 years. Geez.
2 years. Yeah. Yeah. But it was a case where that particular person didn't, he didn't accept criticism, and he was he would just keep his anger and his feelings all bottled up. And in a band situation, you really just need to let it go and say, "Look, I'm going to be honest with you, and I want to be honest with myself, and I want to listen, and I want to talk, and I want us all to do this. I want us all to be participants." And it's hard to do that. It's not easy. And when you do have it, you have lightning in a bottle. And then it works. Certain bands were that way. Look at Sabbath, for instance. I mean, they were really something, different personalities, people. But when they got together and did those first, I'll say the first six albums especially, they were ridiculous. And there's other bands like that too. Lightning in a bottle. And once you take a piece of that away, it's not the same anymore. It's not as good. It's not as compelling anymore. So it's really, if you have it, exploit it. When did you know, after you got these two people in the band, Mike, when did you know that you had the right four people? When did they actually just kind of...
So, yeah, I will openly admit, our previous guitar player and I, we... learned how to, we had a process, right? So that we both kind of felt good about, all that kind of stuff. Hillary came in and really added like multiple dimensions to it. She could sing, play, write, all that stuff. So, and then also like she has a very strong in marketing and branding and all that kind of stuff. So she brings a whole lot in with that. So when the guitarist said he was leaving, I was like, oh man, I don't know if I want to do this. So it was a point, and I've had a few, as the other two will tell you, I've had a couple points along the way. I'm like, is this really, do I want to keep going here? Is this something that's worth the time and effort we're all putting into it? And, you know, of course I come around, and I think that's one of the things too. You have to rely on these people, right? That's the big thing. Not only trust them, but like rely on them.
You rely on each other.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And then I feel like we all kind of have similar situations where we're like, oh, I just can't do this anymore. But really, I think for me anyway, it's like, I think about not doing it anymore. I'm just like, it's what we have to maybe figure out. The whole is so much better than the sum of the parts, especially for writing. Like I could write by myself, but you know, it would be consistent maybe at this level. But when you involve other creative people like Hillary and Steve, I mean, you can get places where I would never get by myself. It's a little bit of a balancing act because sometimes it's like amazing. Like we play a song once and it's like, holy cow. And then some days it's just, you know, nothing comes out, and that's fine too. But to get back to your question, yeah. So I was a little kind of like distraught over what we're going to do because we fit well as guitar players together. And I think that's a big thing too. Like you each have to know your role when it comes to having two guitarists in a band. But then Steve enters and he just has, well, he's got a lot going, but he definitely has like this technical prowess and songwriting and all that kind of stuff. So all of a sudden the palette just kind of opens up even further. And then as we've gotten to know him and everyone's kind of worked through, like we're talking about working through how we write and all this stuff. And we still are. I think this is the point where I'm like, I want these people to stay. And I want to see how far we can push this. So yeah, that was the point for me.
So tell me, Steve, a little bit about the songwriting process. I mean, how's that go with a Bellwether Ritual?
Well,
I mean, your first song that was out with the band, I guess, was
Lock and Key.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lock and Key.
Yeah,
and
well, I like to joke about how I'm the junior member of the band. So Lock and Key, for example, is an older song they had written before I joined the band. So this album that we're working on is the first one where I'm really contributing to the songwriting. I wrote my parts for Lock and Key, but the song was written. So in the beginning, it was a lot of just me learning their riffs and their songs and everything, and then once we started with this new album, for me, it was when Hillary came in with a particular riff for one of our songs that I won't name because it's not out yet.
Sure.
And it was just, you know, we all played it together and it just felt so damn good. So it tends to go, you know, a riff, one of us comes up with a riff or we come up with a riff together and then play it until we can kind of think of something else to do or run out of ideas. And then kind of we all go home and mull it over a little bit and think about it and come back with some new parts to it. And then usually Mike will kind of put them together in like a kind of rough mix version and send it out. And because we're all adults with jobs and families and responsibilities, it's not easy to be together and write like we would like to be. But so it ends up being a lot of, you know, sending tracks back and forth with little tweaks here and there. And then we're fortunate enough to have a really wonderful rehearsal space where we can go and turn up and play at gig levels. And I think that's where it really starts to come together. When we play through the song, you can really tell if it's where it needs to be or if certain spots kind of need hiccups or, you know, if there's hiccups that need ironing out. A lot of like the little transitions between parts kind of get missed in the piecemeal kind of approach that it all gets resolved when we play together. And it's just a lot of open communication, and we all really have the music's best interest in mind, and we all want it to be as good as it can be. And we riff around and find out.
There you go. to Steve's credit too, he wasn't one that was like, he jumped in right away and started contributing right away. He wasn't, you know, some people are maybe a little more shy or they take more time. Like I am specifically, I take more time to like eventually open up, where he just kind of came in and, you know, had opinions and riffs and all that stuff straight off the bat. So that definitely helped too.
It's nice having that in the band too. It's nice having somebody who's more extroverted that way. Uh-huh. Somebody who's maybe more reserved and thoughtful. Not that Steve's not, but I'm not saying that at all, but Steve will just come out and this is my idea. And then somebody else would be, you know, so it's nice to have a balance in the band too.
It was a nice infusion of like fresh ideas too. Same with when Hillary came in, it was just like, all right, this is a completely different perspective and just the way they write and bring stuff in. And like I said before, if you go listen to our first EP, it's so different, but I don't know.
If you listen to the first EP and then you listen to the second EP and then you listen to Lock and Key, which is the only song, you know, that was post that, you can even hear it there.
And I think we're even in a bigger one coming up with the album.
So. I can't wait to hear it. And by the way, when's this coming out? Damn it.
Well, I don't know if I want to. We're going into the
studio.
What's the
target?
We'd love to be done by Halloween.
Okay.
We have a show to play on July 26th in Bethlehem. And then right after that, the drums are going to start in the studio. So Brenton's going to jump right in there. He said he wanted to break in his new drum heads at the show. And then we'll roll right into the studio.
Oh, Brenton has no drum heads to
play. Yeah. Yes. So. And he is our recording engineer. He produced all the tracks that we've recorded, including the first one. And he is a very I think it's unusual. Like all he needs is a guitar track and a click track, and he can just go in and just bang his parts out.
Crazy.
Which I don't know. To me is I can't do that. So
that's very professional.
He's the most reliable drummer I've ever played with. It's like it's amazing. Which is like, all right, we're gonna start at the second verse, play through the end, and he's like, okay, let's go.
Yeah.
And a good dude
he's,
too.
He's definitely top notch. I was listening, like I was telling Mike before the podcast today, today was my bellwether ritual day. Where I listened to everything over and over again, including two donut shop videos. I was completely taken by the indoor one, even more than the outdoor one, because I was telling Mike, it's like, I'm watching this thing and I can't stop. I just doom scroll past this stuff, right? And like, I listen to 10 seconds, 20 seconds, like, but I couldn't stop listening. Right. It was just compelling. I said, they're in a donut shop. It smells like donuts in there and they're playing this music. It's great. So I listened to the whole thing. And then of course you had the big outdoor event in May where you had the giant Hulk outside, which was awesome. And it sounded great. Was that donut shop the first time you played Lock and Key live? In January?
I don't remember now.
I feel like maybe we test drove it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Usually that's the way it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it got lots better by May.
Yeah.
It was good. It was really good. I enjoyed that. And then with your permission, I'm going to close after we're done talking and close the podcast out by playing the full version of Lock and Key, which I pirated using my Mac and Audio Hijack.
Oh, we can just give you the MP3 too.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't pirate it. I got it from Mike. At Bellwether Ritual.
Yeah.
So here, let's peek behind the curtain just for a second. You guys obviously don't do this to make a living, because none of us musicians really make a living doing music. So what do you do in your real lives? You start, Mike.
So right now I freelance for a couple of clients, doing anything from database, importing, exporting, video, editing, website development, kind of a mishmash of a whole bunch of, it's Beerus, what's up, buddy? A whole bunch of different things. I'm trained in graphic arts and then kind of picked up web development and, you know, as things roll out, social media, that sort of thing. So,
great.
So,
how about you, Steve?
Well, So I've been a stay-at-home dad for about 9 years, and I did sort of make a living. Why is my cat wet?
Oh,
I did sort of make a living with music. I was in a cover band, a couple of cover bands for a number of years. One of which got fairly successful. We toured up and down the East Coast and everything. But I also own an instrument repair business, www.theotherluthier.com. So I fix guitars for a living, and
Great. I'll stick that in the show notes as well.
Oh, cool.
And he has a wet cat.
And, I do have a wet cat. Yeah,
you have a wet cat. What's your cat's name?
Beerus.
Beerus. It was nice to meet Beerus for just a moment.
Can you please make that the Instagram soundbite? Just
that. Yeah, I do my own guitar work here, so I can understand. I take care of my own babies, and number one, I'm cheap, and number two, I just want to learn how to do it.
That's why I started doing it, man. My family was very frugal growing up, and we didn't throw things away, and we just fixed things that broke. And
I think I got tired of trying to hunt down a good place to go and somebody I could trust. And then I didn't want to. I have a 1983 Guild Pilot that is just precious to me. Yeah. It's a natural bass. Oh, hang on a sec.
Yeah, please.
Oh boy, look at this.
Here she is.
Oh, yeah.
And she's, I don't see too many of these, built in Westerly, Rhode Island in 83. And it's a natural maple with an ebony neck. And I didn't want to give this to anybody to mess with because I did not want it damaged because there is not a replacement. And I love her and I cherish her.
Does she
and
have
I
a
don't
name?
Ever let her go. Huh?
Does she have a name?
I can't tell you.
No.
Why is it wet though? Is the question.
That's it. I can't tell you.
She doesn't have a name. She doesn't have a name, but she's very precious to me. And so I learned how to do it. You know, I learned how to do fret work and the usual setup stuff. And the only thing I'm not really great at is the electronic stuff. But I stay with it. And my next project is I'm going to put some Seymour Duncans on my Fender to give it some punch and get rid of the old Fender made in Mexico pickups on there.
Yeah.
So we're going to play around with that a little bit. Hillary, what about you?
Well, I too have been fortunate enough to not only play in this space, but I work in the guitar space. Awesome. I have spent my entire career doing marketing in some form or another for a number of manufacturers. That's why I moved to the area to work for a certain guitar manufacturer that's based in the Lehigh Valley. That's 200 years old. You may know them as Martin Guitar.
Yes.
But previously worked on the West Coast at some other manufacturers that you might know. I'd say my specialty is in the digital space. And, you know, Mike and I like to talk shop about all things marketing. And so I think we bring that to the table as well. But I've been privileged enough to do that for the entirety of my career. And prior to that, I started as a music journalist. So wrote for magazines, wrote for Spin, wrote for jazz magazines, just followed bands around. And I feel like that was the most kind of romantic era of my life. And sometimes I just want to return to being a penniless journalist. But that's really how I kickstarted my foray into copywriting and moving up in the world of guitar manufacturing.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I'm a lot older than you, and I'll tell you the same thing I tell everybody. It's like sometimes you save what you love to do as a hobby and you do what you want to do, you know, that you can make a living as a living. And you're a good bass player. Okay. You know how to play the bass, you have good stage presence, and you sing well, and it's something, it would be a criminal shame for you not to keep playing. I think all of you guys should keep doing what you're doing, because I think people, once they hear what you do, because it is different, okay? It's not like every other, I don't even know how to categorize you. Doom metal? I don't know if you say that, but I don't really see that. You're a different sounding band. And it's very catchy, it's very appealing, and it's something you can listen to for an hour and a half, you know, and have a great time. I mean, who doesn't need an hour and a half, 2 hours out of their week where they listen to something that makes them happy, you know, has some good energy?
I think what's interesting, though, it's when we get to the new album, you know, not to go open kimono on this, but I think we're finally finding our stride, you know.
Good.
And I think, again, like what you've experienced, I came in right at the I think just as we were recording the first the four track album Windbag. And I mean, you can see the I don't know if it's as much a diversity of sound as it is an evolution that's, you know, gotten us to this. I mean, that's my, maybe, you know, guys might disagree, but I think that journey has taken us to this point that we're at right now. So it's exciting to see all of that come to fruition.
I'm excited to hear it. So hurry up, get it done. I'll give you off this podcast so you can get back to work.
Yeah. Maybe we can send you some demos or something in the meantime.
That'd be great. How does it work with you guys being an original song band in a sea of cover bands? Do you end up having to play, like when you play out, do you play any cover tunes at all?
Steve, why don't you let us know?
Yeah, well, no, we don't play any covers, although we are kicking around the idea of doing a Sabbath tune this weekend.
Steve.
Sir.
Please do Into the Void.
Okay. You got
it.
I
was listening to that literally 10 minutes before I got up here to my computer, and I'm thinking, those guys would murder that song.
That's a great idea.
Into the Void from Master of Reality.
Master of Reality, yeah.
I mean, I was just going to verbalize my opinion on the best album, but I think you know what it is at this point.
Well, that was the one that snagged me. So,
yeah, and then, I'm a doomer at heart, man. So yeah. I feel like that is just the start of it all.
Yeah, I think you guys could really put your own stamp on that song, but you know, that's just me. You know, who writes riffs better than Tony Iommi, right? I mean, maybe Jimmy Page, right? He's a riff master as well.
Yeah, they're hard to top.
They're the best, and Tony Iommi is just.
I just love his backstory too. Like, guy gets his fingers cut off last day of work and thinks that's it. And then gets a Django Reinhardt album from one of the people that was by him and said, look, this guy did it too. And then invents a whole new musical style.
Yeah, I got to say on that thing, I was talking to the guys the other day. I have an injury on my hand from about 10 years ago. I impaled my finger with a chisel. And it was fine for years. And just recently, I think from all the covers, I mean, we were doing, you know, 3 gigs a weekend for 4 hours, you know, it's starting to really fucking suck. Am I allowed to curse? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So it's like, I'm really drawing on my Tony Iommi and Django Reinhardt. Just got to keep pushing through. If I got to play like this with 3 fingers, so be it. But
is there anything you can do for the finger?
I'm not sure. I'm going to see a doctor soon, hopefully, but I basically cut the sheathing around the tendon. So it gets numb and it hurts and I can't bend it right. It kind of looks stupid.
Well, you'll feel sorry for me because at that very show that Mike saw at Grumpy's, I had a blister on my one finger that I had to pluck with, and I had to wear a Band-Aid on it. And the Band-Aid kept flying off, and I kept looking for the Band-Aid because I only had one Band-Aid. And it was my own damn fault because I should have built my calluses up before I start playing out with this band. But there was no time. We had to play. I know you feel for me.
I bet that made eating the barbecue really difficult, too.
Well, yeah.
Did you learn to always keep Band-Aids in your gig bag after that?
No, but I do keep my calluses nice now.
Nice. Oh, good.
So we're good.
It's important.
Yeah, Very important. Just so if you're playing with your fingers, you got to keep those going. That's why even being bandless, I got to play for like an hour a day or I lose my calluses.
Yeah, definitely. You had mentioned cover bands and originals, though. I just wanted to get back to that really quickly.
Sure.
I don't think I've ever played in a cover band, and it's not because I don't like them or don't think they have their place. I think they're great. Steve was in a great cover band who did a lot of playing and touring and all that. It was just something that never really resonated with me as much. So when I do want to spend my time doing this, like I really enjoy the process of creating and building a song from scratch. So that's really why I think I get into it more. And that's what keeps me going.
I think the results show that you really do love it. And another point on your engineering from your drummer, if you listen to your latest single and your latest EP, that you have out right now, you can hear the attention to detail there. You can just hear these little tiny, very precise guitar parts, these little riffs, these little picks, these little things. And then you hear the bass, the tone is just spot on. And I'm going to ask Hillary about her equipment in a little bit, but because I'm going to steal everything she does.
Spoiler, it's pretty simple, but
yeah. But I'm a big fan of that, by the way. A lot of people
that's
don't
something I noticed
that.
When I was learning all the music, listening to the Windbag EP, specifically in Brick by Brick, and the one verse, or it might be the chorus, they're saying Brick by Brick. You hear Breton hitting the ride cymbal, and it just sounds like somebody tapping bricks in place. And it's just like all those little things. It's just, it adds up.
Yeah, and that's part of that creative thing Mike was talking about. These are the things that when it's the four of you, it's the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, or is it the other way around?
It's the other way. We know
it's the other way around. Okay. Lehigh Valley music scene. What's your opinions on that, Hillary? You start.
Oh, that's gonna be interesting. Well, no, because you're kind of from the outside more.
It's like a weirdo. No, it's so great because it's so organic. And I mean that, and just it's the grassroots elements of it are really there. I think that people make a concerted effort, and you can tell that people are really passionate about it. I think when you go into some of these bigger cities, I hate to say it, but like there's a little bit of an air of pretentiousness. I mean, you kind of have your top dogs like in every scene that, that kind of command the scene, and it's harder for smaller bands to break through. But I do feel like people make a concerted effort to support one another. It's not to say that that doesn't happen in other cities too, but you can tell that people are really committed to like supporting the grind and promoting each other, which I think is really great. But then on top of it, you have access to a number of cities around you. So you just kind of get the breadth of influences from Philly, which has a great scene, and New York that clearly is New York. We've been talking about that there's big doom metal scenes in Baltimore and kind of that area. So you get this kind of surge of influences from all these cities coupled with the support of the community around here. It's really DIY, but you can also see it growing. You know, there's a lot of new venues that are coming up, that are popping up. We have a couple big ones that just showed up in Allentown. So I think we're due for, a big resurgence in this area, which is super exciting. And it's nice to be at the forefront of that as a group.
Yeah. Post-COVID, I mean, COVID really damaged the music scene, I thought. And it's nice to see some of that come back. What do you think, Steve? You've been up and down the coast. What do you think the music scene in Lehigh Valley is like these days?
Well, so like I said, I grew up in a pretty small town near Philly, and that's all the world was to me. And everybody was in bands with everybody, and it was just this beautiful thing. And then after high school, everyone stopped playing, and I moved away and everything. And when I came here, I just wanted to play. So I found every opportunity I could, which is how I ended up doing a lot of the cover band stuff. And that kind of grew for years. And the thing I've noticed is in the cover band scene, there is sort of a lot of that hierarchy kind of, you got to know people kind of nonsense that goes on. But as I'm getting more introduced to the original music scene, I am just blown away every time by the sheer, first off, amount of amazing people are around this area, like write music and make art and everything like that. And just the damn support, you know, like when we played that, the second Curry Donut show with the Hulk in the background, I mean, the Hulk showed up to a gig, but the other bands were all, I mean, they were, you know, I don't know how old they were, but they made us look ancient, you know, and they're all just like doing it from just because they love it and they're supporting each other. And it's just something I wish I was part of a lot sooner, because you know I'm trying to get into it real deep, and it just keeps going. It's so wide, you know.
It's very cool. What do you think, Mike?
So growing up here, I didn't think there were as many opportunities initially. And that is one of the big reasons I wanted to move down to Philadelphia. Unbeknownst to me, as I moved down to Philadelphia, there's a place called Second Avenue on in West Bethlehem that kind of exploded, and they had a whole scene over there, yeah, which was awesome. And then when I came back, it was kind of a mixed bag because I stopped playing for a while and all that kind of stuff. I've also worked at a couple of music venues around the area, and I'll say this. I feel like sometimes, like any scene, it could be a little clicky. But once you find how to approach people and really, I think the best way is go to shows, you know, like you were saying, just show up to people's shows, and you tend to get a lot of doors open for you like that because you're out there doing it, and that clickiness kind of goes away relatively quickly. And to both Steve and Hillary's point, especially with the original stuff, it does really feel now more so than in the past, like there is this swell. I'm not sure if it's from like the COVID, because a lot of people started bands in COVID, and I feel like there's been this swell in the number of bands, but now those are either kind of, they're either kind of sinking or swimming at this point. So a lot of for us, I think a lot of it's just trying to keep the longevity of it going, and we can build on that and yeah, keep trying to move things forward. But overall, I think it's it has a bright future, and there are a lot, it is very community based. So sometimes you have to kind of break into those communities, but yeah, overall, I think it's poised for a lot more growth. So I'm excited to be a part of it.
I hope you're all right. I'm more pessimistic, I guess, about some of it, because I was in a band. My real short history was I was in a band for a few years ago, 35 years ago. Wow.
You're from
and
the
we played around Bethlehem and Allentown and opened for Greg Howe and How To, and we used to be called the Airport Music Hall, and you know. We were making, you know, I would pull in 100 to 200 bucks a night as a bass player, you know, and now today, you know, I could pull in $100 to $200 a night as a bass player. And I'm hoping, you know, I was hoping that things would get better, but they're not. The money went somewhere else. I wonder where it went, but it didn't get into my pocket, but I never did it for the money. I would just hope that it'd be a little bit better by now. And, hopefully, I should point out that some of the venues do pay much better than that. And I'm very thankful for them. I won't name any of them right now because I don't want to embarrass them as far as anything goes. But there are some major venues in Lehigh Valley that pay very well without having to go for part of the gate even. And they just appreciate music, and they appreciate the hard work and all the investment we make in our equipment and our time and our energy. And, you know, I used to work for a living. I'm a retired guy now, so I have a little more time on my hands, but now I got grandkids, so that kind of screwed that up.
I don't believe
congrats
it.
On that.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, babysit twice a week. But I can't imagine not playing. So I'm just going to play. I'm going to play in my office here. I'm going to play out on my front lawn with my Spark Neo headphones on, looking like an idiot, and rocking my Rickenbacker or whatever I happen to have out there. And people drive by, they wave, you know. My wife works for the bus company. The buses go by, and they all give her shit that I'm outside playing my bass guitar. But it's like, hey, it's sunny out. I want to play outside.
Yeah.
Cut me some slack. And I think once music's in you, you just got to do it, you know. And I love new, and I know you guys love creating new songs. I'm not a writer, but I do love learning new songs. And I haven't stopped learning in 50 years now. So, you know, you just keep learning and enjoying it. And as long as it's fun, do it. And you can do it. You know, my fingers still work. So,
yeah, I think that's what we always come back to, is like, it's in our blood, and we're going to do it if we do it together or separately anyway.
So tell me about, you got a, this will be coming out on the 2nd of August. So we've already missed your date on July 26th, but where are you going to be playing on 8/4 and 8/22?
I was going to say, I'm sure it was amazing. So.
Yeah, we can talk about how cool it was. And
you guys missed so much.
Steve took his shirt off and all the chicks came up and yeah, we got it.
Yeah. So we have a couple shows coming up. We're playing Music Fest Monday, August 4th. We're closing out the entire day. So not until 11 p.m. We had this opportunity. I know, right? We had the opportunity and we're like, yeah, why not? Let's do it.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I've ever played Music Fest with a band before. Come to think of it, only as a solo act. So that'll be interesting and fun. And that's the same night as the Black Crows and a couple other cool bands. So you can always check them out and then check us out afterwards. And then August 22nd is a Friday, and that'll be up at Mother Pugs on Staten Island. So our first time out in the New York area as well, and on a pretty cool, pretty heavy bill there. So excited to get out there as well.
Do you guys plan to extend your geographic reach?
Yes, so that's what we're talking about. That's one of the big long conversations that we've been having. We would love to get down, like Hillary was talking about, into the Maryland, Virginia, even North Carolina. They all have strong kind of like stoner rock, doom metal roots there. So I think that would do us well. I'd love to get back out to Chicago, Hillary's old stomping grounds. And then also personally, for me, I would love to get up into Canada because I do think there's some good scenes up in there as well, right over the border. So those are all things that we're trying to plan.
One of my good friends lives in Maryland, and yeah, I can verify there's a taste for what you guys have to offer. Mm. So you should do well going down into Maryland.
Very
cool. Anything else you want to plug or say before I? Oh wait, I forgot one thing. Hillary, your equipment.
Hey, big.
So how many basses do you have, Hillary?
You got some cool stuff.
I may have an addiction, like we all do. You're seeing a couple of guitars. I mean, between the guitars and basses, I have a smattering of, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 guitars that kind of ebbs and flows and grows, as we know. On the bass side of things, I grew up, I mean, I'd say I started out like my favorite bassist of all time is James Jamerson. So I'm a jazz bass girl through and through. Right. And I also have very small hands. So I think just in terms of the neck profile and the place I happened to work at the time, the versatility of the pickups and everything, just the general shape and the fact that, you know, I was inspired by Motown. That was kind of what I gravitated toward initially. When I started developing a taste for kind of more boutique-y kind of Franken-basses, if you will. Uh-huh. And so a lot of my collection are kind of these, like, I don't want to say like pawn shop finds, but these kind of eccentric pieces that I find along the way. As an example, I have a hollow body Hagstrom with flat wounds that I was in a garage punk kind of band for a while. And so I would leverage that. I just bought, in fact, it's right behind me. Hold on.
Okay. Sorry, guys. I need to know all this stuff.
That's cool. The cool stuff.
Very important.
So this one I just recently bought, and we're going to bring this full circle, actually. So he's there, obviously, precision bass player, amongst other things. I stumbled on this when I went to go pick up a 9-volt or something like that. and this was basically it's an American-made P bass that was kind of Frankensteined with new pickups that happened to be Geezer Butler EMG pickups.
Nice.
So I knew it worked for me. Yeah. They redid the body and I got it at a steal, right? They added a drop D trigger on it. I knew it was meant for me. So it's those kind of irreverent finds. The one that I typically play in the band, I mean, a bunch more, but I'd say between this one and the one that I play normally, it's a Thunderbird style Sandberg bass. It's called a 48. And so you get the punchiness and clarity out of this one. And then you get that kind of beefy powerhouse humbucking tone from the other one. So depending on which way the wind blows, you know, in terms of the style that I want.
Yeah.
Those are kind of the two that I go in between.
I try to tell my wife this, okay, I have 6 basses. That's all I have. And I've been playing for 50 years. So I think that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Okay. I mean, but what I tell her is, she asked me, she says, why do you need more than one bass? You can only play one at a time. And I said, they all have their own personalities.
Why don't you need one more?
Yeah. I mean, they have their own personalities. They all sound different. Yep, they all play differently. They all feel differently. And they all have their place in my life. You know, like you were talking about boutique-y basses, right? Here's my boutique-y bass.
Oh, nice.
It's a Spectre.
Spectre, yeah.
So I got a Spectre.
What is it, like a silver?
Yeah, it's a gun. It's called Gunmetal Gloss.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a NS Ethos HP. And that's, you know, it doesn't sound like anything else I have. I mean, it's, when you get down to the lower notes, it's got like a twangy thunder to it. And then it plays kind of mid-rangey. But in some stuff that I play, I like to have a little bit of that. It has that dark glass tone capsule in it.
I was going to say, like, when it comes to, like, I mean, like the dark glass preamps and some of these good things, not in this one, obviously, but like, I think it comes down to some of those bells and whistles that you find in either the boutique-y ones and
and EMGs on it. And by the way, that Guild that I was showing you has EMGs on it too from 83. That's one of the reasons I bought it.
Right.
It's, and they held up great. Do you play directly into your amp or you use any pedals?
Lately I'm notoriously like lazy about setting up my pedal board. I always call it the charcuterie board. It's like very stupid, right? I like to stick with the exception of fuzz, which I'll get into in a second. I usually like to stick with like a holy trinity of pedals, which is like a compressor, an octave pedal, and some sort of fuzz distortion. I'm very tried and true. It's the, what is,
what's Mike, you're not going to believe how close we are on this stuff. It's crazy.
Normally I do play direct. I mean, you can really just kind of tell, well, I wouldn't say normally, but, you know, I think you can really capture the essence of either, whether it's this bass or the other one. I tend to like a blank slate, but like I said, it's just, it's an OC5. It's a standard compressor. And then where I kind of like to dabble in terms of boutique-y fuzz, like boutique-y pedals is fuzz pedals. Uh-huh. I think where the guys and I disagree is like, I'm a tried and true analog girl. And, you know, Mike's like, here, try this Helix Lore board. I'm like, nah, like, no thanks. I'd rather not. So very much like into hand-wired boutique, again, kind of pawn shop finds. I love, like some brands, Death by Audio, Old Blood Noise, Catalin Bread, like kind of the like smaller builders, and then of course like the classic Big Muff, like bass Big Muff pies and things like that. I think that's where I like to experiment, but I'm pretty simplistic when it comes to pedals. And as far as amps, like definitely love a good blank canvas amplifier. I used Fender amps. I love Galleon Kruger amplifiers. I feel like you get some of that opportunity to dial in, but it's still, you know, it's very much kind of, again, an open playing field to doctor it up with pedals if you want. You can really capture the essence of the bass tone through it. So I almost feel like it's a Fender amp on steroids. But yeah, at the end of the day, like, you know, I'll dabble in a few pedals here and there. But I have my areas of experimentation. So
yeah, I started out with a whole slew of pedals on this giant pedal board. And over time, I just decided that, you know, most of this is coming from my preamp of my guitar, my fingers, the strings that I have and the guitar I'm using. So I ended up with just using a Boss GT1B to give me a couple of models that I like. There's a fuzz model. There's a clean model. There's a flanger kind of a thing and a chorusy kind of thing. And I just dialed those in myself because the ones that are built in aren't really very good at all. And then a Keeley bassist compressor.
That's
I love that compressor because all it, I run it light just so it keeps me honest. You know what I mean?
I mean, to me, like, I think that's the best compression that you'll find on the market. They just do a great job. So.
I agree. I think the electronics in that thing are just perfect. And then I use a drop pedal.
Makes
I just use a drop pedal. So it saves me all sorts of hassles. It's good enough to play out
because,
with.
We all have, us bassists all have perfect pitch, so we don't need a tuner, right?
Well, the tuner's built into the GT1B.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So, yeah, and perfect pitch, no. But if it's wrong, it's usually the guitarist's fault, right?
Clearly.
Tune around her.
One thing I will say, Hillary, her tone, she brought in so much of the low end and bass frequencies. I didn't even realize we were missing until she came in, and just the way she puts together her tone, it's like.
So, Mike, now you see how important it is to have a good bass player.
Oh,
right?
I know. Yeah. Right. But my tone, like my bass tone would always be more MIDI, and like I didn't really understand the low end, but. When she brought it in, I was just like, oh, wow. That, like, it's there's power to it. Yeah, like, yeah, that too. Sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was kind of a lesson, I think, in humility for me. Just in terms of, I mean, when you think about like Geezer's influence, even James Jamerson's influence, it's a lot of counterpoint. It's a lot of technicality, like a lot of innovative playing. Sometimes you just have to keep it simple.
Yeah.
And I think this has really taught me it doesn't necessarily, you know, they always say it's not the notes you play. Was that Miles Davis? It's not the notes you play. It's the notes you don't play or something.
Yeah.
Like that. And so I think allowing for that space is really what has helped to give us a little bit more of that atmospheric vibe and round out some of that, you know, as Mike mentioned, that low end that, you know, I think would be kind of discolored if it were overly technical and I was playing like a lot, which there's the right time and place for, but it doesn't always have to be like that.
Right. And I think, you know, my whole opinion on it has always been that as a bass player, I want to make the band sound better. I always tell people nobody goes to hear the bass player when they go hear a band. They want to see the lead guitarist, the singer, you know, but not the bass player.
Oh, they're cuter than us.
Right. Exactly. So. But I think bass players and drummers locking in is important. And I've always tried just to play in the pocket and stay with the drummer. And if there's happens to be a keyboard player, also the keyboards and the bass can have a nice, interaction with each other. And I know some bass players that are a lot better at it than I am, but, that's what I would always want to bring to a band. And that's what I thought I brought to my last band. And I think people agreed with me that the band was better when I showed up. And I thought so too. I thought it was an improvement and it made me feel good when I knew that I was making the band sound better.
Absolutely. Well, and I got to give a shout out to Breton. Like you talked about the rhythm section.
Yeah.
You know, being copacetic. I feel like we have twin language sometimes. I feel like in terms of locking in, we have a great unspoken communication. I think we keep each other in check. We call each other on our bullshit. I mean, we're very honest with one another. I think we know how to compliment each other well, both in the pocket, on stage, and, you know, in terms of talking to each other what we need. And like I think without that relationship, like the rhythm section contribution wouldn't be half as good. So I have to give a shout out to him. Don't tell anyone that I said.
I know I'm keeping you guys long, but I do have one other question. When you're on stage, do you make a concerted effort to look at each other while you're playing?
Oh, I might be guilty of this. I tend to not do that as much as I should. I don't know why. I have to work on that.
Steve?
I feel like I do make an effort. A lot of playing in the cover bands and stuff, there's a lot of that kind of communication that goes on. But, you know, my biggest thing is showing up to the gig and trying to lift everything up and put a smile on people's faces. And when I hear Hillary play a fucking great fill, I make sure to look at her and smile. When I hear Mike do something great, you know, I make sure to shout or something, or, you know, I try to make everyone feel good about what they're doing.
Yeah. Hillary?
Yeah, I think it's something that we're actively working toward getting better at. And I think a lot of it comes down to, like Steve mentioned, those kind of nonverbal cues, right? We have a lot of weird time changes, a lot of weird key changes. And sometimes you get lost in the, I can't say lost in the groove, but you do.
Sure.
And so it's nice to kind of have that security blanket, which, you know, I'll rely on, and it's, I would say Steve especially, to kind of give me those nods just in case. And I think just in terms of overall stage movement, we want to work toward getting, you know, our sound is tight. We want to make sure that the action complements the sound that we're, you know, portraying on stage. So it's definitely important and something we want to focus on.
Yeah. And I think it's, you guys like each other enough that you can look at each other, which is great. I think it does, having that instantaneous appreciation, that feedback from your fellow bandmates as you're doing it kind of adds together and lifts the whole performance up. And then you want to have a good time when you're playing anyway. You know, my biggest problem was I ended up having this terrible resting bitch face. Okay, great. You know, Pete's having another good time. There was a guy that I have a lot of respect for. He says, "Hey, Pete, you sound great, but aren't you having a good time?" I said, "No,
I find it sometimes it's almost too intense to look people in the eyes.
I know. It's hard. It's hard. But it's something I have to work on too. I definitely want to be better at that. Also, be better at singing and playing at the same time.
Oh, that's a skill.
Oh, it's a struggle. Ooh.
Especially when you're a bass player or a drummer.
Yeah, we can't all be Geddy Lee. So
I do think bassist, that's actually one of the hardest ones to do, especially finger style.
Yeah.
I do think that's one of the harder ones to pull off.
So I just got to stop being a baby about it and just practice those songs and sing and play at the same time until, you know, I guess the rationale is you're supposed to learn to play so that you don't have to think about it at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can concentrate on the singing part. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Guys, I thank you so much for staying so long. I appreciate it. I think you guys are great. Mike, make sure you get me all the links you want in the show notes over the next few days.
Sure.
I want to put everything in there that I can. You guys are terrific. I really hope people go out and see you play and listen to you play and see what you're all about, because it's a whole different deal. And it's not your average everyday cover band. You're playing original music that's exciting and has great riffs, and it's easy to listen to, and it's full of hard, dark energy, and you all bring something to the table. You're monsters, and I really appreciate you very much. I reached out to Mike for this for no other reason than I'm a fan.
Thank you so much.
I think you guys are awesome, and I'll be seeing you at some gig in the future. I'll tell you that. I just don't know when, because you're playing during one of the gigs you're playing is during my vacation with my family, so I can't be there for that one. Maybe 8/22, but that's in New York, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
We'll book some stuff in the fall.
We got room in the back seat.
Keep me informed.
We're bringing a clown, so it's all ages. We're doing balloon animals.
All right. Well, thanks very much, best to you all.
Likewise, Pete. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Okay.
All right. Have a good one.